Hey, Kristen, how's it tracking?
With Carvana Value Tracker?
What else?
Oh, it's tracking. In fact, Value Surge Alert, trucks up 2.5%. Vans down 1.7%.
Just as predicted.
Mm-hmm.
So, we gonna...
I don't know. Could sell, could hold.
The power to always know our car's worth.
Exhilarating, isn't it?
Tracking.
Always know your car's worth with Carvana Value Tracker.
Hello. Welcome to the Latin American History Podcast. Episode 124. A brief overview of post-conquest Latin American history. Part 9. The 21st century. Today we finish off our overview series with a look at the most recent history of Latin America. As I mentioned last episode, the new era of democratic politics and economic orthodoxy has been largely sustained, although not always in every country. Left-wing politics has not gone away in Latin America, but, in conventional political terms, it has mostly taken on a more centrist position. Public preferences expressed at the ballot box have seen control switch between left and right at different times, just as it has in Western countries. The big trend of the 2000s was what came to be called the turn to the left, also known as the pink tide. Pink because it was not red like those previous Marxist ideas, but still came from that same tradition to some extent. This saw left-wing governments elected in Chile, Ecuador, Uruguay, Paraguay, Honduras, Nicaragua, Brazil, Argentina, and Bolivia. A couple of those require a little extra examination. Evo Morales in Bolivia became the country's first indigenous president, which made him notable in such an indigenous country. In Nicaragua, this was that re-election of Ortega, which I talked about last episode. So although he was grouped together with the rest of the left-wing Democrats at the time, he has taken a different path since then. Honduras is another example of an exception to the democratic trend, but for the opposite reason. The left-wing president there was deposed in an army coup after winning his election, although his wife now leads the country 15 years later, and it's returned to democracy. Argentina's iteration of the left turn came in the form of the Kirchners, a husband and wife team who both took turns as president. They do fit into this left-turn paradigm, but as always, Argentina's a bit different, due to the shadow of Perón over its politics and the extreme financial crises which shape its political situation. You can argue that the overall balance shifted towards the right in the 2010s, with more conservative politicians being elected in Argentina, Brazil, Ecuador, Peru, and Chile, but that we have seen another, more leftward shift since then in some countries. Two notable examples of this are Boric in Chile, who rose to prominence as a young leader of student protests, and Petro in Colombia, an ex-guerrilla who became Colombia's first left-wing president since the events leading up to La Violencia in the 1950s. In truth, though, as we get closer to the present, region-wide electoral trends are harder to identify. Individual countries have been faced with unique internal circumstances. Politics in Peru, for example, have been very rocky, with a long-serving former president, Alberto Fujimori, spending years in prison for embezzlement and human rights violations committed during the war against the Shining Path. More than one president then being impeached because of corruption allegations, another trying to dissolve Congress and finding himself impeached and arrested, and the current leader who replaced him obtaining dazzlingly low approval ratings. In neighbouring Bolivia, Morales, who had been very popular, attempted to change the constitution so that he could stay in power, but his plan was defeated in a referendum. He ran anyway, but the election was marked by accusations of fraud, and he left for Mexico and later Argentina, amid pressure from the army. An opposition senator took power in controversial circumstances, and the word coup was thrown around. When another election was held, Morales's party won, although he himself could not run. And that previous president is now in prison, accused of things like conspiracy and sedition. Morales and his former ally, now the current president, have recently been facing off against each other in the streets. The political trend which has gained the most attention in the last few years, however, and sent some countries in a different direction, is populism. Latin America has long experienced wider global trends, even if the way those trends manifest themselves has been local in character. We saw that with the Enlightenment ideas which helped spur independence, and of course, with the battle of Cold War ideologies. Now the region has had elements of the most recent Western trends impact it in places. The term populism has become prominent in the West over the last 5 to 10 years, used by some to describe and explain some of the turmoil and the rise of previously unlikely politicians. Populism is not a new idea for Latin American analysts, however. To sum it up in a sentence, it's a style of politics which can come from left or right, and which makes grand promises to the population, often stirring up resentment against establishment politicians and institutions. But critics argue that often those promises are short-termist and lacking in substance. Bolsonaro in Brazil was the most obvious example of someone who has been linked to this political trend seen in the West. Outsiders have often referred to him as the Trump of the tropics. Bukele in El Salvador is another often cited figure. His crackdown on gangs and crime has been extreme, and his advocacy of things like Bitcoin demonstrates an interest in technology, which some who are labelled populists in the West share. He has called himself the world's coolest dictator, but so far he's not had to demonstrate his commitment to dictatorship. The crime situation in El Salvador was so dire that despite human rights concerns, he is still extremely popular and has had no trouble winning elections. Milei in Argentina is another. I actually think that while Milei has used the wider populist wave to his advantage, in some ways he doesn't fit so neatly into the category. Whatever you think of his economic ideas, I think that he is much more well-read than the people considered to be his contemporaries, and his ideas, for better or worse, are pretty developed. While Trump wants tariffs, and Britain's decision to leave the EU is a barrier to free trade, Milei is a market fundamentalist who seeks to tear down barriers. As always, Argentina's the exception. Its politics and economics are often completely unique, and the situation over my lifetime has been so dire that perhaps the reasons for his election, while clearly linked to the wider global trends, have just as much to do with Argentina itself. Another person, usually labelled a populist, is the recently stepped down AMLO in Mexico. In one way, his policies and style are why he's put into this category. But he's usually labelled a left-wing populist, and so in some ways, he also doesn't fit neatly into the category, alongside people like Bolsonaro and Bukele. His policies focused on social programmes and efforts to improve minority rights, which is why he is seen as a left-wing politician. His attacks on journalists and advocacy of direct democracy contributed to his being labelled a populist. AMLO, his successor, the current president, and his party are very popular in Mexico. It was not them, however, who finally dislodged the PRI after 7 decades in power. The reason for the end of the PRI's grip on Mexico are varied and complex, and the loosening of the grip took place over at least a decade. Those reasons include the assassination of a presidential candidate, splits within the party, economic difficulties, and public dissatisfaction with corruption. One day we will look at it all in more detail. It was certainly a shock for them to be out of power, and they did regain the presidency for a term in 2012. They came third in the 2018 election, however, which saw AMLO's party take power. So if that covers the politics since the end of the Cold War, there are some other trends we should talk about. There are some rough patterns we can identify over this time in terms of economics. I should say that economics is not my specialist subject, and these topics, being so recent, are being debated as we speak. This short section won't cover all of the different aspects and points of view. As it's only intended to be a brief overview, however, it should suffice. The last decade before the fall of the USSR, and the first one after it, was marked by what's usually called the Washington Consensus. This was a global policy with its origins in the USA, which favoured free market-based economics. Think Reagan and Thatcher. It advocated for things like privatisation, deregulation, and the use of institutions like the IMF and the World Bank. The results of this, and of the wider economic theory behind it, are debated. In Latin America, the 1980s are often referred to as the lost decade. Many countries in the region found themselves unable to pay their national debts, and one of the results of this was austerity, which hit the living standards of their populations. These were the economic conditions which I mentioned last episode, which helped to undermine the position of the dictators and push them towards giving up power. With the exceptions we looked at last episode aside, an economic grounding in free markets has remained, although this has been tempered to greater or lesser extents, according to the parties elected in each country. The 2000s were largely positive economically. As it did in places like Australia, China's rise was positive for countries, like many in Latin America, which produced resources like metals, as China had an enormous appetite for them to fuel its growth. Things got more difficult in the 2010s, and of course, everything has been upended economically across the world in recent years, with things like the pandemic creating exceptional circumstances, and phenomena like inflation everywhere across the globe. If we are talking about post-Cold War economics in Latin America, we have to pay special attention to Argentina. This is yet another topic which requires much more study to understand than I have ever given it. It's complex, and Argentina's economics must be some of the strangest and most extreme in the world. Tied up in the situation is its unique political landscape, defined by Peronists and anti-Peronists, which, as I've already mentioned, is difficult to understand. The roots of the country's economic issues go back further than the post-Cold War period, but they have really asserted themselves in the last few decades. The country suffered during the 1980s, along with its neighbours, but attempts to stabilise the situation failed, and hyperinflation impacted living standards. GDP did increase, but in 1998, the country entered a three-year recession, which saw almost every economic problem imaginable hit, usually to the extreme. Protests and riots broke out in 2001, which brought down a government, and although the worst of the crisis ended soon afterwards, things never really got overly positive. The country suffered from the 2008 financial crisis and has been plunged into another one in the last few years, which has seen, once again, extraordinary levels of inflation. There are two major political/social/economic phenomena which have also marked the last 30 years or so in particular. Unfortunately, they are best described as challenges. I don't want to do Latin America down by highlighting these problems and indulging in stereotypes, but these phenomena do exist, so you can't really do an overview of recent history without at least mentioning them. The first of these is migration. A few episodes ago, I outlined how Latin America was previously seen as somewhere to migrate to, how it drew in immigrants from all over the world. Obviously today, in popular discourse, it is seen as a place which produces migrants. In recent decades, Mexico and Central America were the place from which most people left for the USA. Today, though, people are more likely to come from Venezuela or Haiti due to their political and economic situations. While many of those leaving Venezuela aim for the USA, huge numbers have headed for other Latin American countries. It's definitely not just the USA taking them in. Many have made homes in places like Colombia, Peru, and Chile, while others have found themselves stuck in countries on the route north. Migration can come from pretty much anywhere, not just the usually cited sources. I have met loads of people from unlikely sources in the last couple of years. 2 years ago, I was in a little town on the edge of the Darien Gap, a dangerous natural bottleneck for people heading north. There were lots of Venezuelans and Haitians there, but there were also groups of people from China, Ukraine, and even Sikhs. The situation in the Darien is pretty bad, and it's not just the burden of taking migrants in which falls on Latin American countries, more than is recognised outside of the region. It also requires resources to manage people as they pass through. The issue of migration is an explosive one in the West, but it's one that's not going away. It's also not just a Latin American issue at all, it's a global one. It, and reactions to it, will be one of the things which contributes to steering the region's future. The other major issue, which I reluctantly have to talk about, is drugs and crime. I'm sure that many of you listening to this, having made the effort to seek this podcast out, have a more developed understanding of Latin America. But unfortunately, for lots of people, these are among the first things which come to mind when you mention the region. Many Latin Americans understandably hate to be associated with this issue, so I won't dwell on it for too long. There is no denying that it has influenced the trajectory and recent history of parts of the region, however. The drug trade is hemispheric, global in fact. It's an industry with people from all over the world participating in moving drugs from the places they are produced to the places where the biggest markets exist. The big one here is, of course, cocaine, which is derived from the coca plant, which grows naturally in the Andes. Earlier in this series, I outlined how Colombia's conflict was primarily a political one, but the latter part of it has been influenced by the drug. As all sides sought out ways to fund their wars, they turned to the obvious cash cow on their doorstep to do so. A major part of the degradation of the ideological vision of the guerrilla groups was the money they gained from trafficking. The right-wing paramilitaries which opposed them also got involved, and of course cartels with no political mission except profit emerged. Soon battles became about control of coca fields rather than implementing political visions, and some individuals happily switched sides between the three categories of organisation, seeking out whatever would bring them the most money. Like the FARC, the main coalition of paramilitaries disarmed in 2004, but some have morphed into cartel-like organisations. The situation also instigated one of the US's more recent interventions in Latin America, this time though with the collaboration of the Colombian government. Plan Colombia saw American planes used to spray coca fields with pesticides to try to stem production between the years 2000 and 2015. In neighbouring Peru, the remnants of the Shining Path have reportedly also started engaging in trafficking to fund themselves. The trade has affected almost every country on the route between source and market. A Honduran president recently stood trial in the USA for trafficking, and other members of Latin American government and military institutions have faced similar accusations. Cocaine has helped Brazilian gangs cement their power as they are on the route to Europe, and it has caused instability in Central America. Bukele's popularity in El Salvador is because of his crackdown. The biggest gang there demonstrates the complex way in which history and the international nature of the trade are interlinked. MS-13 was actually founded in the USA by refugees from the Civil War living in the poorer parts of Los Angeles. They came together to protect themselves from existing street gangs there, but once they became too large and disruptive, many were deported and brought the gang problem with them. Their country, like their neighbours, sits right on the route northwards, which gives them access to a lucrative income stream. In the last couple of decades, while the various organisations which produce cocaine in Colombia are still very powerful, the pole has shifted north to Mexico, and the cartels there have grown and become the most dominant links in the chain. This has caused enormous instability in the country and elsewhere. Ecuador is an example of the international destabilising nature of their power. Until no more than 2 or 3 years ago, it was a relatively peaceful country, but one sandwiched between the two biggest producers. Mexican cartels have formed alliances with previously small-scale street gangs there, increasing their power and spurring a bloody conflict between them. This has rocked the country as they fight it out for control of the coastline. Ecuador doesn't really produce cocaine, but it's become a useful transit point. To further highlight the global, non-exclusively Latin American nature of the situation, Eastern European organized crime groups have been detected in Ecuador, also using it as a place of transit. Linked to the migration issue are environmental ones. While we may have seen a decline in ideological social movements, environmental activism is a big, although often dangerous, thing in Latin America. The region is home to some of the largest and most important ecological zones in the world, but also to large-scale damage to the environment. There are many who dedicate themselves to defending the natural world, but Latin America has by far the highest number of murders of those activists. One of the most famous was Berta Cáceres, and she also illustrates how environmental activism often connects to indigenous movements. A small but precedent-setting example is Guna Yala in Panama. Many of the Guna indigenous people live on tiny low-lying islands, but as sea levels rise, their homes are sinking beneath their feet, and some are already being forced to leave. We will probably see more climate-induced migration in coming decades, and this is part of the reason I say that the issue is not going away. Guna Yala offers a small glimpse into that potential future. Economically, perhaps soon politically as well, another recent trend is China's growing interest in Latin America. This is happening in many parts of the world, so it's not exclusively a Latin American thing. But as the region has traditionally been within the sphere of the USA, it does demonstrate current fluxes in the geopolitical balance. China is investing in development and infrastructure projects, providing an alternative source for Latin American countries to the previously standard Western institutions. A good, although unrealized, example of this are the proposals of Chinese companies to help Nicaragua build that long-posited canal. This hasn't happened, and obviously right now there is discussion about their influence around the Panama one. That aside, obviously, if they had helped construct one in Nicaragua, you would have seen China potentially actually having a large amount of control over international trade in the Americas, in partnership with a nominally socialist Nicaraguan government. I personally don't think we've seen much of a political impact from China's interest in Latin America so far. The impact has mainly been economic. Who knows if that will change in the future, however. In terms of social history, one of the big shifts in recent Latin American history is the growth of evangelical Christianity. The region has been a bastion of Catholicism since the Spanish and Portuguese first arrived and started converting the people they found there. In the last 50 or so years, however, evangelical Protestant forms of Christianity have made big inroads. A lot of missionaries have come, particularly from the USA, and had success in their work. It's not uncommon to see Jehovah's Witnesses sitting in the town squares of even the most remote of towns, and to see buildings with the organization's logo. A recent survey suggested that almost half, 49% to be precise, of Brazil's enormous population no longer calls itself Catholic. Now, some of those will have become irreligious, but if current trends of Catholic decline and evangelical growth continue, it won't be too long before the latter actually has more followers than the former. I had considered ending this series by engaging in some speculation about what the future holds for Latin America. I decided, however, that this would probably be foolish. Making these kinds of predictions are always difficult, and even the most informed commentators risk being proven wrong. Until the last few years, there were some global certainties around which predictions could be made, or at least we thought there were. In its most optimistic form, that end of history idea suggested that eventually pretty much everywhere would stabilise into democratic, capitalist places, and that this would gradually bring prosperity, human rights and happiness. In Latin America you could, and still can if you choose to, point to the democratisation of most countries and economic growth to support this. Today those certainties are looking more and more uncertain. Who can say with any confidence what will happen in Western countries over the next decade? Who can predict China's trajectory? We've seen time and time again in this series that things happening outside of Latin America affect what happens inside Latin America. And so given that external uncertainty, I don't really know how I could make any confident predictions about its future. Hopefully though, this overview series has helped to explain how the region at least got to where it is today, and might provide context for whatever does come next. So this brings our overview series to an end. Of course, there is so much which I've omitted. And while everything in it I believe is correct, I wouldn't be surprised if when I look at some of these stories in detail for future episodes, I find that I feel that perhaps shifts in emphasis might have made this or that part of the series slightly more accurate, according to a better understanding. That is what history is. Often historians argue not about facts, but about how to interpret those facts and fit them into a wider story, or about which facts to emphasise and prioritise over others. Even if that is the case, I think though that this series does achieve what I aimed for when I conceived of it. The big trends, events and ideas I have outlined should help to give you a rough idea of the trajectory of Latin America over the last 4 or 5 centuries. And so it should be easier to fit future episodes into that wider context, and hopefully that should make them more enjoyable. If you've enjoyed this episode and the series as a whole, and you want to do something to help out, one thing which really helps new people to discover the podcast is leaving a review wherever you get your podcast from. A huge thank you to everyone who's already done this. And thank you to everyone for listening. You've been listening to the Latin American History Podcast, written and recorded by me, Max Argent, edited by Alex McNamara. If you've enjoyed the podcast and want to get access to extra episodes, you can become a friend of the podcast. There's information about how to do this in the episode description. The podcast is also available on YouTube by searching for the Latin American History Podcast. If you'd like to send me a message, or if you have any questions, you can email me at historyoflatinamericapodcast@gmail.com.
Hi, I'm Kristen Bell. Carvana makes car buying easy. Isn't that right, hun? Dax? Dax?
Sorry, did you know about this 7-day money-back guarantee?
A week to evaluate seat comfiness, you say?
A week of terrain tests? Yeah, I can test the brake pad resistance at variable speeds.
Make sure all the kids' stuff fits nicely.
Make sure our stuff fits nicely.
Oh, the...
Right. Still need to buy the car. Getting ahead of ourselves here.
Buy your car with Carvana today.